A few of us have seen the two Russian satellites orbiting above our heads. More of us have heard rebroadcasts of the radio sounds which they signal back to Earth. These two flying objects moving about our Earth at incredible speeds signalize dramatically the dawning of a new age. It will be called the age of space flight. It will be the age in which previously earthbound man will cast off this earth limitation and will begin to adventure into and pioneer some of the frontiers of the universe. It seems that in the history of human invention, man's fancy, man's imagination outruns his capacity to produce. Well over 3,000 years ago, Greek legend tells us of a master mechanic, Daedalus, who created the first successful man flight. This very mechanic was imprisoned by the king of Crete, he and his son. He determined to escape, but the usual avenues of escape were closed to him. He resolved to try and fly over his guards and thus escape the prison house. And he took the feathers of many birds and he fashioned them into a pair of bird-like wings held together by clay and by wax. And he put these wings upon his shoulders and arms and upon the shoulders and arms of his son Icarus, and they began to fly and escape this prison. And the legend tells us that Daedalus did indeed successfully escape from Crete as far as Sicily by air. Only his son failed in the flight because he attempted to fly too high into the heavens. And the heat of the sun's rays burnt the wax which was holding the wings together and he plunged into the sea. And according to tradition, these wings which Daedalus used to escape from the prison of Crete were dedicated at the temple of Apollo in Sicily, kept there by the altar as a reminder to man of this great accomplishment not to be repeated for some 3,000 years. And after 3,000 years of thinking, of imagining, after men like the universal genius Leonardo da Vinci had actually sketched a workable scheme for a flying machine, man, within our lifetime, within at least the lifetime of some of us here, learnt the art of flying. And now we think nothing of spanning this continent in a matter of hours. Space flight grew in much the same way. For a century now, we have been told by the writers of science fiction about new worlds into which we can ascend. It is a century exactly since Mr. Jules Verne wrote a very beautiful and imaginative story about a rocket train to the moon. And he and Mr. H.G. Wells and their many, many co-authors in the field of science fiction made our minds familiar with the geography of other planets, with Martian men, and with some of the scientific difficulties of space travel. And we all remember, I think, with tolerant good humor, that day some 20 years ago when Mr. Orson Welles produced Near Panic on the eastern seaboard of our country, when in a very realistic radio broadcast he described the landing upon the fields and marshes of New Jersey of some thousands of men from Mars. Now most of us, as late as October 3rd of this year, consigned most of this discussion about the possibilities of space flight to the area of science fiction. It was a literary conceit. It was a product of man's imagination. And we felt it had little real possibility of being made part of the program of our daily lives. October 4, we awoke. And we awoke to a new age. Sputnik 1 was flying above our heads at 18,000 or near to 18,000 miles per hour. It took it less than 90 minutes to circumnavigate the globe. This year, which had seen us enjoy the limitations of several generations ago, which thought that it was still a matter of dare whether a man could circumnavigate the globe in 40 days, this generation, this year, we had to accustom ourselves to the possibility of circling the earth in a matter of minutes. We awoke in a new age, the dawning of a new century. We awoke to many new problems and concerns with which I should like to deal this morning. What will this new age mean for man? It will mean, first of all, I think, that we will have to accustom ourselves to an entirely new concept of distance and of speed. Some of us are still amazed at the possibility of boarding a flight here in Cleveland and 3 or 4 hours later arriving at our Pacific coast. We are overwhelmed by the speed of the Sputnik, close to 18,000 miles. And yet we will have to accustom ourselves to even greater speed and even more telescoped distances, because the scientists are telling us that in the years ahead, through means of new power propulsions, through ions and by means of photons, man will someday learn to travel at speeds close to the speed of sound, close to 186,000 miles per second. And Venus, our nearest planet, which is 25 millions of miles away at the nearest point between its orbit and ours, and Mars, which is 35 millions of miles away, will seem to be as close to us as Tokyo or London or Rome. And the nearest star, which is 25,200,000,000,000 of miles from this Earth, can be reached in a matter of years rather than of centuries. Man will begin to explore first the near reaches of this universe of ours, and then he will probe ever further into the mysterious unknown which surrounds our Earth. It promises to be a great and wonderful age in which to live for us and for our children and for our children's children. None of us can conceive of what this new age will mean for man. None of us knows of the new discoveries about the fundamental laws of the universe, those laws which govern the movement of the most gigantic of galaxies of millions of stars, and the movements and genesis and decay of the most minute subatomic particle. Principally, this new age will bring to us in this generation new knowledge, because the satellites and the rockets and the spaceships will be used first and foremost for research. We will be told a great deal about the nature of the atmosphere which surrounds our world. We will learn a great deal more than we now know about that which causes our weather to change. Long-range weather forecasting will become a matter of detailed accuracy. And one can imagine the great blessing and boon that this will be to man. We will be less and less subject to the apparent whims of nature. Scientists tell us we'll be able to predict years of drought and years of excessive rain, the genesis of the tremendous tropical storms which so disturb that part of the world. We may even learn how to make the great deserts blossom and the frozen northlands grow again with greenery. We will learn a great deal about the use of our radio and television waves, how to make it possible for them to travel unimpeded and uninterfered with through our space. We'll be able to map the mineral resources of this world and to map accurately the topography of our Earth. We will learn a great deal more about that mysterious force which we call radiation. Medical science especially will be interested in the effect of cosmic radiation and of all types of shortwave radiation upon human tissue. And in these studies, they may find cures for the diseases which still baffle medical research person. Cancer, the mysterious process of debility and senility and death, decay. All these will be searched out, and undoubtedly startling new discoveries will shower down upon us. Truly, this age promises to be one of great boon and great blessing to our Earth. It will be possible for us to travel out into space. It will be possible for us to search out answers to questions which still intrigue us. And probably the first question which each of us must ask and will ask is there other life in this universe of ours? Is man unique? Does life exist only upon this Earth? Or are there other planets circling around other suns in this galaxy or in any other on which there is life such as we know? Will this life be primitive, much like the life which Columbus found upon the shores of North America when he discovered this continent? Or will it be a type of life higher than man, superhuman, with a higher degree of culture and of civilization than the human species has developed? We do not now know. The most powerful telescopes which we have been able to devise will never be able to tell us, because they cannot magnify sufficiently even the closest planets to answer this question for us. We do not now know. But as we read the literatures of the physicists and the biologists and the astronomers, one is struck by the almost unanimous affirmative answer which they give to us on this question. Yes, they do believe that life exists elsewhere in this globe. They argue from the laws of probability. They tell us that this universe and the stars of which it is composed, the great solar systems of which it is composed, came to be in rather uniform ways, following basic laws of nature. And just as it was possible for our sun to develop planets which circled around it within its gravitational field, so in our own Milky Way galaxy, where there are 100 millions of suns similar to ours, there are probably millions of planets also similar to ours, with temperature ranges, with atmospheric conditions, much like that which features this Earth. They tell us that there is life elsewhere in the universe. Mr. Fred Hoyle, a noted British astronomer, estimates that in the Milky Way alone, in this galaxy of which our sun is just one small star, there are probably 1 million planets somewhat similar to the Earth on which life can exist. And there are in this heavens of ours hundreds upon thousands of multi-million star galaxies, each with its own potential for holding life. Yes, the scientists believe that we will find life as we course out into the universe, but we will not know until we travel, research, and report. What of our own solar system? Is there life on any of the other planets which circle this globe? Again, we do not know. Scientists tell us that the planets which are closer than Venus to the sun are too hot to sustain life, and the planets which are further than Mars from the sun are too cold to sustain life. Venus is the planet most like ours in size and in shape. Some believe that it has an atmosphere capable of sustaining life. But in one of the miracles of scientific ingenuity, the atmosphere which surrounds Venus has been researched, and we know that it consists primarily of carbon dioxide, where our atmosphere, our air, consists primarily of nitrogen. And so if there is life, it is life which will have to have developed different systems of breathing than those to which we are accustomed. Is there life? We do not know. We shall have to go and to see. Mars, the planet immediately outward from us, from the sun, seems to offer a more promising prospect. The great telescopes of Mount Palomar have told us that Mars has two polar caps of snow, much like the poles which top and bottom this Earth. They seem to see on Mars patches of red and of green, which enlarge and decrease, apparently with the seasons. And some scientists have said that these represent some form of simple vegetation, expanding into more northerly and southerly regions during the summer months of Mars and contracting during its colder periods. The famous canals of Mars are held by some to be watersheds, carrying the water which would be necessary to irrigate large areas, permit them to grow vegetation. Is there life? We do not know. There is the possibility of life, that is certain. But we shall have to go, and we shall have to see. And the amazing thing about this new age is that soon we will have the capacity to go, to research, and to find out. Because we will have developed the powerful propellants which will permit a spaceship or an unmanned rocket to break out of the Earth's gravitational field. And we will have solved, the scientists tell us, within a matter of years, the many troubling technical scientific problems which still impede the actual sending out of such ships. Because we will have to experiment successfully and solve the problems of the weightless isolation of the universe, and of its intense cosmic radiation, and of its unrelieved darkness. But these aeronautical engineers, these scientists and physicists tell us that these problems can and will be solved. And our generation is not one which will again close its ears to such prediction. The first trips, which these manned or unmanned rocket ships will take will be to our own planet, to the moon. You may recall reading in the papers just last week that there was a great deal of speculation that the Soviet Union would send a rocket missile to the moon on the anniversary, on the 40th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. Obviously, they have it in their potential to send such a rocket ship there now. We certainly are not far behind. It will be only a matter of years, perhaps, until a ship manned by men is sent out to our moon and circumnavigates it and returns to us. But we know that there is no life on the moon. To go to the moon is simply a research advantage. We want to know its mineral composition, its geography, and its topography. We want to take a look at the back of the moon, which man has never seen. It will afford us another point of reference in space from which to make accurate astronomical observations. And I think this research potential of the space age is the first potential which man will realize, because space flight will be used in the decades ahead and possibly in the centuries ahead, primarily as an instrument of research rather than a means of transport. We have spoken already of some of the benefits and boons which earthbound man will gain from this research. We cannot predict others. But it is interesting to remember that the satellites were first sent into space as a research complement to the International Geophysical Year, as a means of studying certain predetermined problems to which the scientists now want an answer. And they will find the answer. And their answer will bring healing and blessing to man. But it will bring also danger and tension to our society. Every new age has dawned uneasily. It is not easy to accommodate a pattern of living, economic and political routines, to new invention. You'll recall that when the first steam engines were introduced into the factories of England during the early days of the Industrial Revolution, the workers organized themselves into mobs and ravaged the countryside, breaking into the factories and breaking these engines in order to, or so they thought, protect their jobs. I'm reminded of the line from the book of Proverbs: in much wisdom is much vexation. He who increases wisdom increases also his sorrow. For truly our potential for sorrow, for human anguish, is greatly increased by this dawning age. Not only the overwhelming fear that the new rockets will carry a warhead rather than a research head, but also the fear that this new age will bring about the end of the great democracy in which we live. Democracy will be greatly threatened by the economic and by the political ramifications of space flight. It will tend to concentrate power into the hands of a few. It will inevitably tend to force government to underwrite research, because no single institution, no single pocket can absorb the high cost of such research. And where there is government subsidy, there is always the danger of governmental control. Scientific know-how will bring power to a few, and our society will have to learn to accommodate itself to the institutes and the pressure groups which the scientists will inevitably develop. We will have to develop a modus vivendi by which our traditional civil rights, the traditional principles of humane living and the high standard of living which we have adopted, can be accommodated, can be developed, and can be enlarged in the new age. And I do not believe that this problem will be easily solved. We've already seen some of the pressures which impinge upon our society because of this space flight. Already our school systems are being subjected to great pressure to increase the amount of science in their curriculum and in their requirements. Already we are wrestling with the problems of making the scientist a more of a status figure in our civilization, so that we can attract more of our bright young men and young women into this field. Already we are creating jobs in our government which give to scientists untrained in fields of government, though highly trained in their own specialties, great power, great control over the future welfare of our nation. And these pressures will increase and double and redouble themselves. We will have to ask ourselves whether man can control his scientific creation, or whether we have breathed life into a golem, into a scientific monster who will overwhelm us, and instead of bringing us blessing, bring us only hurt. I know deep down in my heart that man has the capacity, the courage, the understanding, the wisdom to accommodate his society to the new age as he has accommodated every previous society to every previous scientific invention. But I do know this, that it will require the concentrated and cooperative efforts of men of goodwill in every country and every walk of life. They must be determined. They must be fixed in their purpose. They must be dedicated to the basic principles of humane rights and civil rights. Together they can create a paradise here on earth. They do not work together. We can create a holocaust here on earth. I feel that man himself senses this power which he now has to create the good life and not to fall into the cataclysm, the caverns of defeat. Think of man. Think that in the calendar of world history, man came into this world but a minute, 2 minutes ago. Look at him then. He stands before you naked, toolless, homeless, fireless. He has no power save that which he has in his own two hands. He has no civilization save some instinctive ability to garner food which permits him to survive. This is the man who tamed the wild animals that he might ride them and use their power, who cultivated the wild grains and brought sufficient food to his families and to his clans, who fashioned the natural ores of our world into tools of great precision and great usefulness, who tamed his own wild passions and learnt the arts of community living. This is the man who learned to use fire, who learned to use the metals, who learned to sail the seas, who created great religions to sustain him and to encourage him, who created great works of beauty to enthrall him and to ennoble him, who fashioned the disciplines of medicine to heal him and to give succor and sustenance to his body, who began to think about his world, to raise himself above the fears with which he was born, the limitations with which he was born, the ignorance into which he was born, and to create for himself a civilization whose breadth and whose depth can but amaze, but enthrall. Often he was stopped for a moment. Tyranny and ignorance, selfishness and short-sightedness, all these stood as obstacles in his path. But somehow, in every age, in some way, new light, the new light of knowledge, the new light of learning, the new light of technique and of know-how, insight into his own situation, into the situation in which he found himself, the world, was added bit by bit to the storehouse of world knowledge. In its pursuit, he crossed oceans and deserts, vast uncharted regions. He braved great peril, and now he stands before you. Poet, author, healer, scientific genius, will man who has come so far lack the courage and the ability and the willingness to sustain what he has achieved? To take a new invention as radical as was the control of fire, the development of the simple hatchet, or of the steam engine, or of the plane, and use these for his benefit rather than for his hurt? I think that man can and will show the courage and the willingness to sacrifice, which will bring blessing in this new age. And as he walks down the way into the future, man of the space age will find that he does not walk alone. God, as always, walks at his side. And I think that this man of the 20th century and of the 21st century will be more conscious of the sustaining power of God than was man of our century and of the last century. Because as he probes into the universe, as he sees and is awed by its overwhelming power, by its expanding infinity of distance, by the hundreds upon millions upon billions upon trillions, our language lacks the correct words, of planets and of stars which inhabit it, as he understands the secret of the power which moves it orderly, purposefully, through time, this man can but be amazed at the power of the God who created it, who fashioned it and gave it form and purpose. He will be closer to God than perhaps we are, locked into our cities, away from the fields, away from nature, and not open again as he will be to the mysterious tremendum, the holiness, the universal power which is revealed in the heavens. Man's mind cannot comprehend the heavens beyond. And as the spaceman probes these new frontiers, he will find that always beyond him there are areas yet to be researched, frontiers yet to be broached, mysteries yet to be explained, power and purpose yet to be exposed. He will live close to God. He will feel God's benign purpose and his love. And drinking from this newfound fountain of faith, faith in himself and in his God, I am confident that he can make the space age into a truly blessed age for man. He must learn to cast aside all philosophies of despair, all theologies which limit man's power, which speak of man as impotent, inable, unequal to the task. He must cast aside all atheistic philosophies and agnostic philosophies which do not give him the sense of cooperative power with God. He will do so. He will find again the value of the two basic principles on which our faith is based. Faith in man, who is little lower than the angels, though he is limited by his own humanity. And faith in God, creator and sustainer of the universe, who spoke and it was, who gave us life because it is good. Amen.